are happily jaunting through a series entitled, Who Do You Say That I Am?, which is a question about Jesus, and a historical question, but also a modern question about who Jesus is and who Jesus was and what that means for us. Today, we're going to talk about Jesus as king. I would like to ask a couple questions. What the heck is a king? Any guesses? What is a king? What first things come to mind? What is
guy in charge?
Rules the country.
Big boss.
Big boss. Okay. Ruler, king, in charge. What does the king wear?
Crown.
Anything he wants to.
Robe. Anything he wants to. Purple. Very nice. I did the socks on purpose for the message for today. So for those of you who are just wondering why I'm not matching, how do people know that the person is king? What are the things that seem to indicate to the people that this is the person that is the king?
He lives in the biggest house.
Biggest house.
Very rich.
Very rich.
The outfit.
Clearly the robe, etc. Has an army. Okay. What else?
Everyone looks at him.
Nice. Has a giant throne.
Dignified.
A fear. Okay, beautiful. How is a king celebrated? How do you take somebody and make sure that they become king? What's the process by which that happens?
Coronation.
Very nice. Yeah, studying that little history. What kind of power does a king actually have?
Absolute.
Sometimes none.
Absolute and sometimes none? Sometimes no power. Okay. But who should be king? Kind of the question of what kind of character, what kind of person should be king?
Noble.
Wise.
Gracious.
Knowledgeable.
Fair.
Beautiful. And how do the people address the king? Oh my, we have, for those of you listening to the pod, we have some gestures.
Shalom.
Of shalom. Yeah, very nice. Is there something, now this is the next thing, like part of the celebration, there's usually a theme or an anthem that follows in throughout history. There's a theme, so I thought this theme was appropriate for this particular kind of idea. Many of us have named some of these ideas, so this is the appropriate theme for this king.
I'm gonna be a mighty king, so enemies beware.
Well, I've never seen a king of beasts with quite so little hair.
Sing along.
I'm gonna be the main event, like no king was before. I'm brushing up, I'm looking down, I'm working on my
roar. Thus far, rather an inspiring thing.
Oh, I just can't wait to be king.
You've rather a long way to go, young master.
Here's the key thing, right here.
No one's saying do this.
Now, when I said that,
no one's saying be there.
What?
No one's saying stop that.
No, what you don't
no
realize.
No one's saying see here.
Now see here.
We don't run around all day.
Well, that's definitely out.
Freedom to it all my way.
I think it's very clear that we have nailed it. You guys mentioned it. Rulership, kingship, I can do it all my way. This is obviously the classic definition and pretty much the predominant definition and understanding of king all throughout the ages, even to this particular day. We use it all, obviously, on the playground. King of the mountain! Who made you king is going to be a theme in the biblical text. So king idea, we pretty much have. This is it. King means ruler, in charge, authority, power, strength, do whatever I want, dress whatever I want. Big throne, big celebration, coronation. These are the images and ideas that come to king. We also need to say that kingship, or the idea of a kingdom, or the idea of God being king, is a predominant theme throughout the entire text, throughout our entire story, and throughout the faith tradition. Many of us know this particular song, King of Kings and Lord of Lords, glory, hallelujah. This is something that we used to sing at camp. And then one of the things that you may recall, and this is just a reminder to get us caught up to speed, is that the predominant enemies that are found throughout the text are all kings. In fact, the push of the good news or the push of salvation, the push of justice, is because there are certain people that are in charge who are the kings, who are the rulers, who are the authorities, who are the people that dominate how life and governance, et cetera, is supposed to happen. And these people are not ruling very kindly, or they're not doing things in a way that causes human flourishing and economic justice for all. Let's just take one example of Herod. You guys have heard of a guy by the name of Herod, right? We know him mentioned in the gospel accounts very, very little, actually, just at the very beginning of Jesus' life. These are a list of some people that are part of Herod's circle. And if you read Herod the Great's history, and he's actually known as Herod the Great because he built a bunch of things. For those of you who walked through Israel, the land, and got to see all the buildings and the construction projects, it's just stunning and amazing the kind of projects that he built. But the ancient Jews, the ancient Israelites, did not call him Herod the Great. They called him Herod the Wicked. Why? Because this is a short list of all the people that threatened Herod's throne and his king, his kingship and his rulership and his authority. So he murdered every single one of these people, including the slaughter of the innocents that we find in Matthew chapter 2. The babies, because there was somebody who was going to be born king of the Jews. So he decides that rather than any child, and I'm looking at a beautiful baby child Prudence here, rather than a baby threatening my throne, it's best to dispatch them. Now, the very last piece here mentioned 1,000 Jewish aristocrats upon his death. He actually ordered that this happened so that there would be mourning in the land when Herod died. That's a little bit, gives you a little bit of an insight into his mind and his sickness. It is accounted that that actually didn't happen. So fortunately, we can probably wipe that off of the list there. But you just take a short list. This doesn't even include, I didn't even include the 2,000 people that were crucified when Herod became king up in the northern portion in a place that you might know called Galilee. So when Jesus is doing his ministry in that location, it's kind of stamped with this tyranny, this oppression of Herod as the king. Many of you know that during the Christmas time, we will sing about and talk about and celebrate Jesus as king. And Isaiah chapter 9 is one of those predominant passages. And for unto us a child is born, a son is given, authority rests on his shoulders. But we may not fully grasp that this is rulership, kingship, power kind of language here. Great will be his authority. There shall be an endless peace for the throne of David and his kingdom. So king is really central to the Christmas theme as well. We will establish and uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time onward and forevermore. Of course, the wise men, the magi come. And how many were there? We don't know. That was a trick question. Sorry. There were three gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh, but the Bible doesn't actually tell us how many. So I'm going to say, I don't know, 27. So there were many wise people that came to visit. And what is the declaration? What is the question that they ask that causes Herod, of course, to get all up in arms about threats to his throne? Where is the child who has been born king of the Jews? This is a clear insult and affront to Herod, because Herod had to go to Rome and say, I want to be king. And he had to vie for the position. He had to lobby for the position. But this young child was born king of the Jews. Many of you know that ancient Rome is the context for the Jesus story, and horses play a predominant role. If you read about the horses being part of the major transport, of course, for the Roman army, this is a transport of which you are going to war. But did you know that there was also another animal that was also ridden upon during times of peace? They were magical animals.
Hey! I can fly!
He can fly!
He can fly!
He can talk!
That's right, fool! Now I'm a flying, talking donkey! You might have seen a house fly, maybe even a super fly, but I bet you ain't never seen a donkey fly!
The donkey was actually, we have some ancient archaeological evidence that would suggest that donkeys were ridden far before horses were ridden. And there is a suggestion, although it's a little bit fuzzy and unclear, but we do have depictions of people riding donkeys in the ancient world, both on coins as well as on artistic graphics and sculptures, etc., which seems to indicate that a donkey would have been ridden not during times of war, but during times of peace. So some scholars have hinted at that in addition to Jesus riding the donkey into Jerusalem on Passover and during that season, that in addition to it being a fulfillment of the prophecy that we find in Zechariah, it may also be an indication of his kingship, but a different kind of kingship, a different way of being king. Perhaps one of the most significant themes throughout the text that would indicate king is a predominant theme in our faith tradition is the word gospel. Have you ever thought about the word gospel being a kingly word, a kingly term, a term to indicate power and authority and position? This stone is a Priene calendar inscription. It announces the birth of Caesar Augustus. It is found in Berlin. It dates somewhere around the 9th century. I won't read the entire thing to you, but it's a description of Caesar Augustus who's bringing in a whole new kind of world, a whole new kind of reality. And notice the phrase that is used here. And since the birthday of the god Augustus was the beginning of the good tidings for the world that came by reason of him. That, my friend, good tidings is the word gospel. That's the word evangelion, or where we get our word evangelical, the good news, the gospel. So even the word gospel that we use in our modern English is a representation of the kingship of Jesus. King is a predominant theme throughout the entire faith. You cannot almost flip any page without running into the idea of king, authority, lord, etc. And that idea of king is addressed, argued with, and then, of course, applied to Jesus. So what I'd like to do, as we've done before, is just state, Jesus is king. I don't think there is any doubt that any of us can have regarding reading the text and understanding our tradition and even studying Jesus, that the gospel writers declare that Jesus is king. But we're going to ask another question. If Jesus really is the king, and if Jesus is the king of the world, what kind of kingdom is it? And what kind of king is Jesus? We start by just noticing that one particular gospel is going to take this theme and push it to the nth degree. Matthew chapter 1 starts off with an account of the genealogy. It's telling a story in the line and the tradition of the Jewish tradition. This is Jesus. Luke chapter 1, many have undertaken to compile a narrative. If you want to read about history and maybe a little bit more of a crafted historical or biographical account of Jesus, you read Luke. John, in the beginning was the Word was with God. We talked about what that meant in the word logos a couple weeks ago. John is heavy theology, metaphysical ideas, metaphors and pictures and images of who Jesus is. But notice how Mark starts off his gospel account. The beginning of the good news of Jesus, the beginning of the gospel. Now, this is significant. You would think that the entire, all four gospels would start with, this is the good news of Jesus, and no doubt it is. But Mark is very specific in saying, I'm going to tell you an account of the good news, the evangelion, the evangel of Jesus, which seems to be the same usage that the inscription was applied to Caesar Augustus, the Roman ruler, the king, the Kaiser, the Caesar. And that, my friends, is a very intriguing title and label. If Mark is using it in that same line, then there's probably something about the emperor, probably something about the installation of the emperor, what the king wears, the songs that are sung about the king, the character of the king, all those questions that we talked about before that we should probably pay attention to. That study is a very long one. What I'd like to do is just focus in on one idea which is the coronation. Because Mark seems to take this particular pattern and apply it directly to Jesus in a way that's pretty stunning and is screaming off the page the installation and the coronation of Jesus as the king. Now, many of us know this is an election year, of course. And so there's going to be, sometime very soon, some of us are very excited about this time. Some of us are a little nervous about this time. Nevertheless, that time is on its way, where we are going to coronate or install and celebrate with pomp and circumstance a new ruler, somebody who is now in charge. Well, guess what? That tradition is something that people, communities, societies have been doing for millennia. We seem to have a pretty decent indication as to the process and the manner by which the coronation of Nero Caesar happened through authors like Suetonius, who's an ancient historian, and Dio Cassius. So what I'd like to do is outline for you just very briefly what we can glean from these ancient writings to say, just like we have a coronation, there's a parade, there's an installation, then there's a gathering at the Capitol, then there's a speech, and then there's a laying of hands on the Bible, there's raising of the hands, there's the Supreme Court justice, right? We have our own methodology for installing the person who's going to be our ruler. So did they have a very similar idea. First, it starts with the Praetorian Guard, gathers to hail Caesar as Lord and God. So you have the entire, let's call them the ancient Roman secret service, shall we? Declaring that Caesar is going to be Lord and God. And after that declaration, there's a procession because every good king definitely needs a parade. So there's going to be a procession through the streets of the city. Caesar is then going to be accompanied by people who are going to carry the implement of the victim's death. Now, I think this is one of the pieces that I missed in there. There is a sacrifice in the ancient Roman celebration coronation tradition where a bull or some sort of animal would be accompanying the Caesar all along the way. And at the very end, there would be the sacrifice. And so Caesar is going to be accompanied by somebody who is carrying that instrument of death to slaughter that particular animal as part of the coronation process. They're going to arrive at a place called Capitoline Hill, which is also known as Head Hill. That's what the word capital means. And Caesar is going to be offered wine mixed with myrrh. And the reason why this is because this is a very high class kind of a drink. And the reason why he's going to refuse it and he's going to pour it out is because he doesn't need to express himself as the leader. Everybody knows who he is. The bull is then going to be killed, and I apologize about the numbering here. And then the emperor is going to ascend the steps of the temple with the high priest on his right and his commander on his left, affirming his glory. Caesar takes the place, he's installed, he's high, and he has people flanking him on his left and on his right to declare and once again affirm. Caesar is acclaimed Lord and God as people sing his praises, very much like what we do sometimes in our celebrations. And then the culmination of the coronation of this particular emperor is that they wait for a sign from the heavens to declare. For Nero, for Augustus, for others, it was a comet that would show up into the sky. A sign from the heavens that would declare clearly the gods have ordained and approved and instantiated this person as king. This kind of coronation service and celebration would happen every time Caesar took the throne. Every time that would occur, the people would gather around and there would be a celebration. And that kind of coronation service and celebration would clearly indicate Caesar is king. And Caesar will be king. And we are now subjects under his rule and authority. And if you read the gospel accounts very carefully, and for those of you who have the pieces of paper, I'm going to invite you up now. Come in order, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And what I'd like to do is take you through the very end of the gospel according to Mark. The very end of the passage where Mark seems to take this very pattern that we find in Suetonius, in Dio Cassio, every single piece of that and seems to indicate, oh, you think Caesar is God. You think Caesar is king. You think that is what, that person is the ruler? You've got another thing to think about. So number one, the Praetorian Guard gathers to hail Caesar as Lord and God. And Mark 15 says this.
Then the soldiers led him into the courtyard of the palace, that is the governor's headquarters. And they called together the whole cohort. And they began saluting him, Hail, King of the Jews.
Thank you, Jesus. Next, Caesar is dressed in triumphal purple garb and a crown of laurel on his head, and a scepter is placed in his hand. Mark 15, verse 16.
And they clothed him in a purple cloak. After twisting some thorns into a crown, they put it on him.
The next step in the coronation process, they lead Caesar on a procession through the streets. Mark 15, verse 19.
They struck his head with a reed, spat upon him, and knelt down in homage to him. After mocking him, they stripped him of the purple cloak and put his own clothes on him. Then they led him out to crucify him.
As Caesar is processed through the streets, there is a person who accompanies Caesar carrying the implement of the sacrifice's death. Mark 15, 21.
They compelled a passerby who was coming in from the country to carry his cross. It was Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus.
Arriving at Capitoline Hill, Caesar is offered wine mixed with myrrh, but he refuses and pours it out. Mark 15, verse 22.
Then they brought Jesus to the place called Golgotha, which means the place of a skull. And they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it.
After that refusal, the bull, or whatever animal, is sacrificed and killed in honor of the newly installed king. Mark 15, 24.
And they crucified him and divided his clothes among them, casting lots to decide what each should take.
The emperor ascends the steps of the temple, and the high priest is on the right, the commander on his left, both affirming his glory. Mark 15, 27.
And with him they crucified two rebels, one on his right and one on his left.
Caesar is therefore then claimed Lord and God. And people sing his praises. Now, instead of singing praises, Mark seems to do something very different. Mark 15, verse 29 through 32.
Those who passed by derided him, shaking their heads and saying, "Aha, you who would destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." In the same way, the chief priests, along with the scribes, were also mocking him among themselves and saying, "He saved others. He cannot save himself. Let the Messiah, the King of Israel, come down from the cross now, so that we may see and believe." Those who were crucified with him also taunted him.
The final step is to look to the heavens to see if somehow the divine would affirm and give approval and blessing. Mark 15, verse 38, and verse 33 and 38.
When it was noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 in the afternoon, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom.
Thank you, all you readers. Throughout history, we have seen the coronation of kings. From the ancient times, as we mentioned at the very beginning, to install a king is to install somebody of power, great wisdom, great might, great authority, the ability to do as the king wants, to rule the people however the king wants to rule. It appears that Mark is taking that pattern of coronation and using it as a pattern to say, we too have a king. But this particular king is not installed in the same way. And these little twists and these turns and these nuances and these flips of phrases seem to indicate that the coronation of Jesus ends not on a throne, but definitely at the hill, Golgotha, also known as Head Hill. And instead of the throne, and instead of great glory, there's humiliation, sacrifice, a cross, crucifixion. And this story seems to indicate that this is what our King is, looks like, wears, what he wears, how he is celebrated. What kind of king is this? It is the kind of king that willingly lays down his life, power, and authority for the sake of a higher cause, a higher, a deeper principle, a broader sense of value. I don't think there's any doubt throughout the gospel accounts and the rest of the stories that are told about Jesus that they are installing him as king. We can declare Jesus as king. The problem, of course, is that when we use the word king, we think of Simba and rulers and powers. And even to this day, people will read the story of Jesus as king and say, I too want to have that same power and glory and authority and might and ability to tell other people what to do and to force my will upon the people. And yet we seem to have completely missed, or we seem to have completely been blinded to this coronation, which is the king that lays down his life in service of others. Will Durant and Ariel Durant, one of my favorite authors on history, has written extensively about pretty much everything throughout history. You can get their volume series. It's something like 12,000 pages. It's insane, and it's wonderful, everything that they write. In this very short summary of the lessons of history, there's a section on war and conflict. And they write this: the causes of war are the same as the causes of competition among individuals, acquisitiveness, pugnacity, and pride, the desire for food, land, materials, fuels, and mastery. We've been dealing with the same kind of thing all throughout history. I love, their writing, acquisitiveness, pugnacity, and pride. People want to be king. I just can't wait to be king because of all the things that I get to do. And there's something really pernicious about that seduction of power that Dr. Keltner has written very brilliantly in his book, The Power Paradox, How We Gain and Lose Influence. It's very true that one of the reasons why we gain this influence is because of how we serve other people. We gain and maintain power through empathy. But in our experience of power, we seem to lose our focus on others. We gain and maintain power through giving, but when we are feeling powerful, we act in self-gratifying and often greedy ways. Dignifying others with expressions of gratitude is essential to achieving enduring power, but once we are feeling powerful, we become rude and offensive. We build enduring power by telling stories that unite, but once we feel powerful, we tell stories that divide and demean. He goes on to talk about how the effect of power on our minds, our psyches, reduces empathy, increases self-serving impulsivity, increases incivility and disrespect, leads to narratives of exceptionalism, activates the stress response and the stress hormone cortisol, which leads him to suggest that power can actually cause brain damage. It can actually corrupt our thinking and the way in which we process the world. And what does Dr. Keltner suggest that we do when we are in positions of power to try to return to those original conceptions of how we have made life better for others? It's not terribly complicated. Practice humility, give to others, and advance justice, which is to fight socially, politically, for those who do not have power. It sounds a lot like a king that I read about in a book that we try to understand and study. My friends, kingship is one of the most prominent themes in our faith tradition. It is very clear. Jesus is king. We can even use this particular symbol, and I know it's a very complicated symbol, but we can use this symbol to describe and to declare, yes, Jesus is king. But the question, of course, is, it's amazing how we use that symbol to sometimes depict the complete opposite of what the gospel writer, specifically Mark, is suggesting about the kind of king that Jesus is. Jesus is coronated as king through the procession in the same pattern and way of Caesar. But as king, he decried tyranny. He tore down all the forms of tribal exclusion. He fought against abuses, deplored the hoarding of power, and he worked against all forms of injustice. As king, he laid down his life. He humbled himself, sacrificed himself. He lived true to his moral convictions. He upended what ruling is and should be, transformed our understanding of power. And as king, as the enthroned one, as the one coronated as ruler of all, as Lord of lords and King of kings, he elevated service and sacrifice as the ultimate expression of authority. Throughout history, I got to ask the question, who does this? Who rises to the position of power only to give it all away? Who attains positions of power, rulership, lordship, mastery, only to lay it down? Who in history with high power and authority chose to use their power, lay it down in service of a greater cause, a higher value, a bigger vision than their own power? Who does that? And if you ever find anybody in this world that does that, it is an historical anomaly because it doesn't happen. The answer to that question is pretty simple, in my view. Who does this? Followers of Jesus, that's who. Because our king, clearly coronated, exalted, raised to the height of social influence and power, because he did all those things, fought against injustice, loved people, expressed empathy and compassion, tried to instantiate those values in his followers. So we elevate him as king, and even then, as we elevate Jesus as king, the ultimate ruler, the ultimate authority, King of kings, Lord of lords, the image and picture of Jesus that we see is one who is sacrificed, laid down, humiliated, completely laid bare. So, my friends, call Jesus king, absolutely. And then ask yourself the question, what kind of king do I follow? And if I am a subject in that kingdom, I should probably pay attention to how my king acts and see how I can do likewise. As we come to communion, this wonderful celebration that we have every single week, it is once again amazing. It is odd if you think about it too much that we claim that we eat the body and the blood. Why so visceral? One of the reasons is because the idea that we follow somebody who sacrificed is not just an idea. It was embodied in the actual person of Jesus. And so we consume representations of that body because we want to also embody that same kind of sacrifice. So as we sing, we're going to be invited to come and take communion, where we are reminded once again of the kind of king and the kind of ruler that we follow. For in the night in which he was betrayed, our Lord Jesus took the bread, blessed and broke it, giving to his disciples, saying, "Take, eat, "This is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." And likewise, after supper, he took the cup, gave thanks, and gave it to them, saying, "Drink this, all of you. This is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for you and for many for the forgiveness of sins. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me." My friends, please come and sing, for all are welcome at this table.